From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We are the sons and daughters of this struggle, and it is our mission to complete the revolution they began on our two continents.
As President Bush continues his five-nation tour of Latin America, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez speaks out against Bush at a mass rally in Argentina.
Neoliberal capitalism is the principal cause of the misery, of the exploitation of the people. That's the main cause of the misery. You are the cause, mister. Get out of here. Gringo, go home.
And we'll also be joined by South African poet and activist Dennis Brutus. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Colombia, 120 people were arrested Sunday during President Bush's visit to the capital of Bogota. Protesters clashed with police as Bush met with Colombian President Álvaro Uribe during a brief seven-hour trip to the capital. Thousands of protesters took to the streets to criticize President Bush's foreign policy.
He represents the crimes that imperialism has committed since the beginning of the 20th century and through this century. He's assassinated thousands in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Palestine, and he continues to assassinate people, trade unionists, independent farmers in Colombia. That's why we're burning this rubbish flag.
Colombia was the third stop on President Bush's five-country tour of Latin America. Today's in Guatemala and Mexico. Friday, President Bush held a news conference alongside Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva.
America gets enough credit for trying to help improve people's lives. And so my trip is to explain as clearly as I can that our nation is generous and compassionate, that when we see poverty, we care, that when we see illiteracy, we want to do something about it, that when we find there to be a deficiency in health care, we'll help to the extent we can.
Meanwhile, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has been conducting his own tour of the region to counter Bush's trip. On Friday, Chavez addressed tens of thousands in Argentina. On Sunday, he met with Bolivian President Evo Morales and Ricardo Alarcón, the president of the Cuban National Assembly.
Mr. President of the United States, what is the fundamental cause of this poverty and of this misery? This is what you represent. The empire is the main guilty party. Neoliberal capitalism is the principal cause of the misery, of the exploitation of the people. That's the main cause of the misery. You are the cause, mister. Get out of here. Gringo, go home.
We'll hear an excerpt of Hugo Chavez's address in Argentina after headlines. President Bush has approved sending 8,200 more U.S. troops to Iraq and Afghanistan. The troop escalation comes in addition to the 21,500 troops Bush ordered to Iraq in January. On Friday night, President Bush officially asked House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for $3.2 billion in emergency funding to pay for the troop increases. In Baghdad, representatives from 13 nations, including the United States, Iran, and Syria, held a closed-door summit in the Green Zone Saturday to discuss the situation in Iraq. Iran demanded a timetable for withdrawal. The U.S. accused Tehran of aiding Shia militias. On Sunday, at least 58 people were killed in attacks across Iraq. In Baghdad, 31 Shiite pilgrims died in a car bombing as they returned from a religious festival. Meanwhile, up to 100 Iraqi homes were burned to the ground Sunday. In the town of Muqtadiyah, the houses were set on fire, apparently by Sunni militants, to rid the area of Shia families and to punish non-cooperative Sunni households. Officials are fearing house burnings will become a new intimidation technique in Iraq's civil war. The Los Angeles Times is reporting American military planners have begun plotting a fallback strategy for Iraq that includes gradual withdrawal of forces and a renewed emphasis on training Iraqi fighters in case the current troop buildup fails or is derailed by Congress. Officials say such a strategy would be based in part on the U.S. experience in El Salvador. During the 1980s, President Reagan sent Green Berets to train the Salvadoran military. At the same time, the CIA secretly backed death squads in El Salvador. Meanwhile, the U.S. military is scrambling to find enough troops to send to Iraq. Salon.com reports the Army's 3rd Infantry Division at Fort Benning, Georgia, is deploying troops with serious injuries and other medical problems, including GIs whose doctors have said are medically unfit for battle. Some are too injured to wear their body armor, according to medical records. Pressure is increasing on President Bush to dismiss Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Gonzalez has been at the center of a pair of recent scandals involving the political purging of 8 U.S. attorneys and the FBI's misuse of the USA Patriot Act to gain personal information on thousands of Americans. On Sunday, New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer appeared on CBS's Face the Nation and called for Gonzalez to step down. The editors of the New York Times have also called for his resignation. This comes as more details have emerged in the scandal over the purging of the U.S. attorneys. The McClatchy newspapers have revealed that presidential adviser Karl Rove was urged by the chair of the New Mexico Republican Party to fire the state's U.S. attorney, David Iglesias, because he had failed to indict Democratic officials ahead of the midterm election. Iglesias was fired on December 7th. The White House admitted Sunday that Rove had relayed complaints from Republican officials and others to the Justice Department and the White House counsel's office. Newsweek is also reporting Alberto Gonzalez's chief of staff drew up a list of prosecutors to be fired. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, Democrats have announced plans to hold hearings on the FBI's abuse of the Patriot Act to obtain private telephone, email, and financial records on American citizens. On Friday, FBI Director Robert Mueller acknowledged the FBI broke the law to secretly pry out personal information about Americans. Lawmakers are now threatening to amend the USA Patriot Act and limit the FBI's powers. Last week, report from the Inspector General of the Justice Department also revealed the FBI had an unusual contract with 3 phone companies to provide call records and subscriber information without legal process. Protests are scheduled today outside the Washington Convention Center, where AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, is holding its annual policy conference. The protest is being organized by the D.C. Anti-War Network, the American Council on Mideast Policy, Global Exchange, the National Association of Muslim American Women, and the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. The protesters are accusing AIPAC of bribing and bullying American lawmakers into supporting Israel, often in ways that ultimately harm Americans. Vice President Cheney is scheduled to address the AIPAC convention this morning. Top Democrats speaking at the conference include House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Meanwhile, a United Nations watchdog group says Israel should ease roadblocks and other restrictions on Palestinians and stop building a wall through the West Bank. The UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination also voiced concern at an unequal distribution of water resources, a disproportionate targeting of Palestinians and house demolitions, and the, quote, denial of the right of many Palestinians to return to their land. In business news, the U.S. oil services giant Halliburton has announced it will move its corporate headquarters from Houston to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Halliburton is the biggest U.S. contractor operating in Iraq. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy said, quote, this is an insult to the U.S. soldiers and taxpayers who paid the tab for their no-bid contracts and endured their overcharges for all these years. House Oversight and Government Reform Committee Chair Henry Waxman said his panel will hold hearings on Halliburton's move and discuss the ramifications for the U.S. taxpayer and national security. Nevada Democratic Party officials have canceled a presidential debate co-sponsored by Fox News. The decision was made a day after Fox News Chair Roger Ailes joked about how Senator Barack Obama's name is similar to Osama bin Laden's during a speech on Thursday to the Radio and Television News Director Foundation First Amendment Dinner. Ailes said, quote, it's true that Barack Obama is on the move. I don't know if it's true that President Bush called Musharraf and said, why can't we catch this guy? Fox News coverage of Obama had already been widely criticized. Last week, the filmmaker Robert Greenwald released a short online video featuring clips of recent Fox News clips.
What else do we not know about Barack Obama?
There's kind of been a drip, drip, drip of stuff. His middle name, Hussein. Now the news that he was raised a Muslim.
Apparently, when he was a young boy, he attended a Muslim school, a madrasa. The reason that he's considered such a big deal is simply because he's black.
He is a black candidate surrounding himself with a lot of white advisors.
Neither one of us can point to one thing Barack Obama has done for African Americans.
Well, first of all...
Well, nothing.
Excerpts of Fox News coverage of Barack Obama put together by Robert Greenwald. The U.S. military is defending its decision to force two freelance journalists working in Afghanistan for the Associated Press to delete photos and video at the scene of a U.S. shooting last week. An Army spokesperson claimed that taking pictures could misrepresent what had happened in the incident. Colonel Viktor Petrenko said, "When untrained people take photographs on video, there is a very real risk that the images or videography will capture visual details that are not as they originally were." The Associated Press disputed the assertions. AP executive editor Kathleen Carroll said, quote, "In democratic societies, legitimate journalists are allowed to work without having their equipment seized and their images deleted." In other media news, the California videographer Josh Wolf has now spent over 200 days in jail. He's the longest incarcerated journalist in U.S. history for refusing to comply with a subpoena. He remains in jail because he refuses to testify or turn over unpublished video to a federal grand jury investigating a protest in San Francisco. At Guantanamo Bay, military hearings have begun for 14 men once held at secret CIA prisons. A panel of three military officers will decide whether the men should continue to be held as enemy combatants. Under the rules of the tribunal, the panel can base its decision on secret evidence that neither the captive nor the media is allowed to see. The detained men are not allowed to have attorneys during the hearings. Reporters have also been banned from the proceedings. A United Nations human rights mission has accused Sudan's government of orchestrating and taking part in international crimes in Darfur, where more than 200,000 people have been killed over the past 4 years. The report from the UN Human Rights Council said, quote, "The situation is characterized by gross and systematic violations of human rights and grave breaches of international humanitarian law." In Zimbabwe, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai and dozens of his supporters were arrested Sunday as riot police stopped a planned mass protest. Tsvangirai's lawyer said he's been badly beaten by police in Zimbabwe. They also shot and killed one activist from the Movement for Democratic Change. In other news from Africa, a Somalian human rights group is estimating more than 1,700 civilians have been killed and another 2,000 wounded in Somalia over the past year. In Washington state, 23 anti-war activists were arrested Sunday at the Port of Tacoma as they tried to block the military from shipping Stryker armored vehicles to Iraq. Another three people were arrested on Friday. Here in New York, the Granny Peace Brigade has begun a six-day protest in Times Square. The anti-war group, made mostly up of grandmothers, plans to read the names of Americans and Iraqis that have died since the war began 4 years ago on March 19th. This is 88-year-old organizer Molly Kloppet.
These are wasteless, awful deaths of young people, of children, of women all over the world. This is not just the United States who suffered. How many thousands have been killed in Iraq? Look what we've done to that country. So it's very important, I think, that we give credence to the symbol that they represent of the useless death and destruction that this war has brought upon the world.
That was Molly Kloppet of the Granny Peace Brigade. And in other news from New York, the death toll from last week's house fire in the Bronx has reached 10. All the victims were immigrants from Mali. Most of them were children. They're being buried today in New Jersey. It was the deadliest fire in New York besides the attack on the World Trade Center in nearly 20 years. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has arrived in Guatemala for the second-to-last stop of his five-nation tour of Latin America. He's meeting with Guatemalan President Oscar Berger for talks expected to be dominated by immigration and free trade. Bush has wished visit to the region has been marked by mass protests and marches. In Brazil Thursday, 30,000 people took to the streets. The next day in Uruguay, some 6,000 marched in the capital of Montevideo. In Bogota, police made 120 arrests when 5,000 protesters marched just 1 mile from where Bush held talks with the Colombian president Alvaro Uribe. Bush will travel to Mexico later today for the last leg of his tour. While many analysts agree the president's trip is part of an effort to gain back influence in the region, the White House has sought to portray the tour as part of a humanitarian effort to address issues of poverty. Last week in Washington, President Bush spoke before the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
You know, not far from the White House is a statue of the great liberator Simon Bolivar. He's often compared to George Washington. Jorge W. Like Washington, he was a general who fought for the right of his people to govern themselves. Like Washington, he succeeded in defeating a much stronger colonial power. And like Washington, he belongs to all of us who love liberty. One Latin American diplomat had put this way, neither Washington nor Bolivar was destined to have children of their own, so that we Americans might call ourselves their children. We are the sons and daughters of this struggle, and it is our mission to complete the revolution they began on our two continents. The millions across our hemisphere who every day suffer the degradations of poverty and hunger have a right to be impatient. And I'm going to make them this pledge, the goal of this great country, the goal of a country full of generous people, is an America where the dignity of every person is respected, where all find room at the table, and where opportunity reaches into every village and every home. By extending the blessings of liberty to the least among us, we will fulfill the destiny of this new world and set a shining example for others. Que Dios le bendiga.
President Bush speaking in Washington last week. In addition to the mass protests to his presence in the region, Bush has been dogged by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who's on a counter tour of Latin America at the same time. In fact, Chavez has practically shadowed Bush since the beginning of his trip. When Bush was in Uruguay on Friday, Chavez held a mass rally in neighboring Argentina. When Bush flew to Colombia, Chavez addressed thousands in Bolivia. When Bush was in Guatemala, Chavez is again close by in neighboring Nicaragua. Today, we're going to play an excerpt of one of Chavez's speeches, this at the mass rally in Buenos Aires on Friday. The Venezuelan president launched a stinging attack on Bush, who is in Uruguay, just 30 miles away across the River Plata.
On the other side of the river, that is where that little gentleman of the north must be. Let's give him a big boo.
Yo quiero y estoy seguro que nuestros amigos en Brasilia,
I am convinced that our friends in Brasilia and in Montevideo are not going to feel offended because we would not want to hurt any of our brethren from Uruguay or Brazil. We recognize their sovereignty. We recognize that those governments have the sovereign right to invite the little gentleman of the north if they so choose. But Kirchner and I don't need to plan anything to sabotage this visit, because we are witnessing a true political cadaver. The President of the United States is a political cadaver. He doesn't even smell of sulfur anymore. He doesn't even smell of sulfur or brimstone, if you will. No longer. What you smell from him now is the stench of political death. And not long from now, he will turn to dust and disappear. So we don't need to put forth any effort to sabotage the visit of the President of the United States to some countries. Sister countries of Central and South America, of course. We don't need to do that. It's a simple coincidence. The visit of Néstor to Venezuela and our visit here to Buenos Aires, well, we nevertheless need to thank that little gentleman that's visiting us, because if he were not here in South America, perhaps this event would not be so well attended. We have organized this event to say no to the presence of the chief of the empire here in the heroic lands of South America. The imperial little gentleman that's visiting Latin America today said about 72 or 48 hours ago in one of his speeches, when he was announcing that he was leaving for Latin America, he compared Simón Bolívar to George Washington. In fact, he even said the ridiculous thing, and I can't say it's hypocrisy because it is simply ridiculous, the most ridiculous thing he could say. He said, today, we are all children of Washington and Bolívar. That is, he thinks that he is a son of Bolívar. What he is a son of a... But I can't say that word here. So, he has said, and you should listen to what he said here. He said that now was the time to finish the revolution that Washington and Bolívar commenced. How's that for heresy? That is heresy and ignorance. Because we have to remember, and I say this with all due respect to George Washington, who is historically one of the founding fathers of that country, but we must also remember the differences and how different George Washington and Simón Bolívar were, are, and will always be. George Washington won a war to gain the independence of the North American economic elite from the English Empire. And when Washington died, or rather after his independence and after having been the President of the United States, after ordering the massacre of the indigenous peoples of North America, after defending slavery, he ended up being a very rich owner of slaves and of a plantation. He was a great landowner. That was George Washington. Simón Bolívar, however, was born with a silver spoon. And at 8 years old, his parents died, and he inherited a large fortune, together with his brothers, and he inherited haciendas and slaves. Simón Bolívar, when history led him, and as Karl Marx said, men can make history, but only as far as history allows us to do so. When history took Bolívar and made him the leader of the independence process in Venezuela, he made that process revolutionary. Simón Bolívar turned over all of his land. He freed all of his slaves, and he turned them in to soldiers, and he brought them here. He brought them to Alto Peru and Carabobo, and he worked together with the troops of San Martin to liberate this continent. That is Simón Bolívar. And Simón Bolívar, having been born with that silver spoon in his mouth, when he died on the Caribbean coast of Colombia, when he died on December 17th in 1830, he was dressed with a shirt of someone else because he had no clothes. Simón Bolívar is the leader of the revolution of this land. He is the leader of the social revolution, the people's revolution, the historical revolution. George Washington has nothing to do with this history. It was in 1823 that James Monroe said, "America for the Americans." And when I say this tonight, I say it because I want to remind you, my brothers of Argentina, of Venezuela, and of America, that the presence of the President of the United States in South America represents all of that. He represents that Monroe Doctrine of America for the Americans. Well, we will have to tell him North America for the North Americans and South America for the South Americans. This is our America. The President of the United States, that political cadaver, and when I say political cadaver, he would like to see me as a real cadaver. I want him to be a political cadaver, and he already is. A political cadaver. The President of the United States has the lowest level of credibility and acceptance from his own people. He is the current President of the United States. It would appear that he doesn't even dare mention my name, because he was asked in Brasilia today and in a press conference. I saw it. I watched it at the hotel. And journalists asked him, "It is said that you are here to stop Chavez's movement in South America." And it looked like he almost had a heart attack when he heard Chavez, because he actually stuttered a couple of times, and he actually changed the subject. He didn't answer the question. He didn't answer the question at all. So he doesn't even dare, and I definitely dare to say his name, the President of the United States of North America, George W. Bush, the little gentleman of the North, the political cadaver that is visiting South America. That little gentleman is the President of all the history of the United States. And in the history of the United States, he has the lowest level of approval in his own country. And if we add that to the level of approval that he has in the world, I would think he's in the red now. Negative numbers.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez in Argentina on Friday, speaking before a mass rally of tens of thousands of people. An excerpt of that address. When we come back, response to the Latin American trip with Greg Grandin, who is author of Empire's Workshop, a professor in Latin American studies. We'll also speak with Steve Illner, just back from Venezuela. Stay with us.
Mi canto es un canto libre que se quiere regalar. Mi canto es un canto libre.
Canto Libre, Victor Jara here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at President Bush's five-nation tour of Latin America, Greg Grandin is a professor of Latin American history at New York University, author of Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Rise of the New Imperialism. He also wrote The Blood of Guatemala, History of Race and Nation. He joins me here in the Firehouse studio. On the line with us, I'm joined by Stephen Illner. He's taught political science at the Universidad de Oriente in Venezuela since 1977, author of many books on Venezuela. His latest is called Venezuela, Hugo Chavez and the Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Steve Illner, let's begin with you. You just came up from Venezuela last week. President Chavez gives this major anti-Bush address in Argentina and continues his shadow tour, shadowing President Bush as he travels through Latin America. When did this relationship go so bad between Venezuela and the United States?
Well, I mean, let me say that Chavez had decent relations with President Clinton. Chavez was elected president in December of 1998. So Clinton was, you know, in office for 2 years, Chavez's first 2 years. And even though the United States State Department denied Chavez a visa to travel to the United States to explain his platform during the campaign in 97-98. When he was elected president, he did meet with Clinton twice, and they had cordial relations. Even though there were some differences between the two countries, there were cordial relations. Things started going sour after 9-11 in 2001, when Chavez criticized the bombing of Afghanistan, and the United States momentarily withdrew its ambassador in Caracas, and Colin Powell started attacking Chavez. Chavez, on the other hand, did not respond in kind. He had very moderate words for Bush and the Bush administration. He wasn't polemical. That led into the coup against Chavez in 2002, which the United States supported and justified. And even after the coup, and even after there was so much evidence of U.S. support for the coup, to the extent that the U.S. ambassador met with the coup leader the day after the coup, Chavez was very moderate in his language. It was only in 2003 that, after the general strike against Chavez that lasted 2 months, that he started using the term anti-imperialism, and things quickly deteriorated after that.
Greg Grandin, you've been following this trip of President Bush and the shadow trip of President Chavez, but start off with why Bush is in Latin America today.
Well, it's been presented as a response to Chavez, and I think that may be its most immediate cause. But I think you also have to step back and look at it in the wake of Bush's disastrous failed global foreign policy, particularly the mess in Iraq. The U.S. has a long history of turning to Latin America to regroup after crises limit its power to project its influence beyond its borders. In this sense, a better metaphor for Latin America rather than the U.S.'s backyard would be kind of United States' strategic reserve, the place where the United States turns to regather its power, its energy, before turning back towards the world. First time the U.S. did this significantly was after the Great Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt turned to Latin America to elaborate the Good Neighbor Policy, which became a kind of blueprint for liberal multilateralism, liberal internationalism, which then became the framework for global diplomacy, U.S.'s global diplomacy, after World War I, after World War II, excuse me. Then in the 1980s, the Reagan administration turned to Latin America to kind of junk liberal multilateralism, to rehabilitate American hard power after the multiple crises of the 1970s. So here we are again at a kind of historical crossroads, kind of a recession of U.S. power in the world caused by military overreach crosses paths with a remobilized Latin America. And so once again, we have an administration turning its attentions to Latin America.
What about President Bush's stressing ethanol? How significant is this, making an ethanol deal in Brazil? I'm going to talk about it in Guatemala.
Yeah, I think this is the substance of the tour. I think the other stuff is really just fluff, is all of a sudden Bush's concern for social justice, that he feels Latin America's pain. I mean, it's a kind of an anemic program that he's offering. In many ways, it's not Chavez that's shadowing Bush, it's Bush that's shadowing Chavez in terms of these social issues, the programs that he's offering in terms of housing and education and healthcare are really minimal. It's the ethanol which is key, ethanol and an attempt to kind of build up an alternative to Chavez in Brazil and in Uruguay. Ethanol is key to that because it solves a number of problems if it actually does advance. One is it clearly creates an alternative to oil, which is the base of Chavez's power. But then also, in order for the United States to meet its ethanol requirements, the goals that Bush laid out, it's going to have to import most of the ethanol from foreign countries. If it relied just on corn production in the U.S., it would totally skew and throw off balance the United States' complex food supply system. So it needs to turn to the Americas. So in many ways, when I say that Latin America is a strategic reserve, I'm not using it as a metaphor. It actually is in terms of raw materials, where the United States is trying to turn Latin America into a supplier of ethanol. And it's not just Brazil. I think his trip to Guatemala is including Guatemala in his itinerary, is telling, because Guatemala is one of the most advanced sugar industries in not just in Central America, but in Latin America. It's very competitive, very productive. And one of the things that has irked Guatemalan sugar producers is the tariffs that the U.S. continues to place on sugar imports from Latin America. And this is a way, I think, of trying to kind of consolidate that sugar production, but specifically for ethanol and specifically as a way of importing ethanol in order not to throw off balance corn production and raise the price of grain in the United States.
Greg Grandin, I wanted to ask you on a slightly separate issue, but this issue of the Salvador option that is always talked about for Iraq, that includes the very same people, the military officer Steele, who was in El Salvador in the 1980s, the training of the Green Berets, the secret working with the death squads of El Salvador. And talking about it as an option today in a positive light in Iraq.
Yeah, well, I think it's a euphemism for the imperial use of force and repression in order to restore order. The United States could talk all it wants about bringing democracy and meaningful development to the world, but the fact is that when opposition to its ambitions manifests itself as an empire, as a superpower, it will resort to force and violence, often through proxies. That's the Salvador option. That's what they mean by the Salvador option, the use of repressive paramilitaries, repressive mercenaries in order to establish authority, establish stability in the imperial periphery, and that's what it means. And obviously it comes from El Salvador, a country most closely linked, identified with death squads, but it wasn't just El Salvador, it was Chile and Argentina and Guatemala and many other countries in Latin America that resorted to the use of death squads, often with the encouragement or tacit approval of the United States.
Steve Illner, President Bush refusing to say Chavez's name, something that Hugo Chavez commented on in this mass rally in Argentina. Can you take us forward from Clinton's relationship with Bush to the attempted coup against Chavez in 2002 and the role of the United States?
Yes, the United States has openly, financially and politically supported the opposition to Chavez. And it has to be kept in mind that the opposition to Chavez is what political scientists call a disloyal opposition. That means an opposition that does not recognize the legitimacy of the government, that criticizes everything the government says and does without supporting any of the measures that might be considered positive for the country. It's an intransigent opposition. And that opposition has received millions of dollars from the National Endowment for Democracy, and this has had repercussions in Venezuelan politics. One of the things is that the opposition has become very closely identified with the United States. There's a negative for the Venezuelan opposition that Chavez has exploited. And the opposition has laid itself open to this kind of accusation. The opposition supports a lot of the things the Bush administration does. When the Bush administration denounces the violation of human rights in Venezuela, the opposition harps on that as if the United States is the authority on that issue. So that I think that the U.S. support for the open support for the Venezuelan opposition has really done the opposition a lot of harm.
And today, right now in Venezuela, one of the parts of the speech we didn't play of Chavez is he was talking about the fifth column. He was talking about those who ally themselves with North America in his own country, serving what he talks about North America's, the United States' interests. What about those classes in Venezuela?
Well, I think that Chavez has exploited this issue of the close connection between not only the opposition parties, but also specific interests in the U.S. government. And it just seems that every time that Chavez makes a statement against the opposition, criticizes the opposition, that the U.S. government is the center of attention. And that polarizes Venezuela even further. And this is true with the Venezuelan media. It's true with the Venezuelan business organizations. True with the church, all of which have clashed with Chavez. And the United States has openly supported the anti-Chavez position in each case.
Greg Grandin, how has Venezuela shaped the U.S.'s entire approach now to Latin America? And do you believe that the U.S. is doing the same kind of thing to Chavez that it did to Castro for decades? We know about what was it. We're not talking about we're talking about hundreds of attempts of assassination. This has all now been documented.
Well, Venezuela certainly is shaping the United States' approach. Just you see it in this tour where Bush has parroted the concern for social justice. I mean, it would be hard-pressed to say that that isn't a response to the success of Chavez, to the popularity of Chavez, to the success of Venezuela's social programs and diplomatic financial aid to Bolivia and Nicaragua. The U.S., certainly what's interesting is actually what it's not able to do in comparison with Castro, where during the Cold War the U.S. was able to isolate and get Latin America as a whole to quarantine, to sequester Castro in Cuba. It hasn't had that success with Chavez, and that's what's interesting about the current moment and the weakness of the U.S.'s position. It may mean that they will fall back on more hard power options like coups and covert activities, but in the meantime, what's interesting is just the refusal of even allies like Uribe and Colombia, these are conservative governments, to isolate and criticize Chavez. Certainly Michelle Bachelet in Chile, Lula in Brazil, these countries have refused to work with Washington's attempt to divide and rule in Latin America. I think that actually speaks to the weakness of U.S. position in Latin America for a number of different reasons. One is there's an incredible amount of alternative sources of capital and investment, and Latin America is no longer relying just on the IMF and just on New York creditors and United States financial institutions. That's just an incredible amount of capital built up in Asia and Russia and Europe, the Middle East that Latin America now has access to. This diversification of markets in Europe and these other areas that I just talked about, but also among Latin American nations. So these countries aren't as dependent on U.S. capital or U.S. market as they were in the past. And that's allowed an interesting degree of political independence among Latin American nations. They've roundly rejected most countries, not only the invasion and occupation of Iraq, but the kind of ideological premise behind the war on terror. Refused to kind of substitute the war on terror for the Cold War. The Cold War served as a kind of organizing principle which justified U.S. leadership. They've rejected the premises behind the war on terror. Even countries like Ecuador prior to the recent election, which was ruled by a close ally of the U.S., and Colombia refused to sign on to the exception to the International Criminal Court that Washington has been asking Latin America to sign on to. This is an unprecedented degree of political autonomy from Washington's leadership, and this is one of the reasons why I think Bush has resorted to a divide and rule strategy in Latin America as opposed to marshaling the region collectively as past administrations have tried to do.
Steve Elner, do you think Iraq saved Latin America?
The what?
Did Iraq save Latin America?
Did Iraq save Latin America?
Did Iraq save Latin America?
Okay. I think that it did take some of the pressure off. The United States undoubtedly would have backed up its hostile words for Chavez with more action after the coup in 2002, had it not been for Iraq. It's impossible to say really what form that action would have taken. But in any case, I think that there was a period there in which Chavez still had not consolidated his power. Between the coup and the recall election that took place in August of 2004, Chavez's position was not that solid, and the opposition Venezuela was calling for Chavez's overthrow or ouster, and that happened at the time of the general strike and then the recall campaign. So that during that two-year period, I think the United States might have played a more forceful role in opposition to Chavez, and that might have weakened his position. But one thing to keep in mind, Amy, is that since 2004, Chavez is solidly in control, and the U.S. options are extremely limited. There's nothing the United States can do in order to destabilize or weaken Chavez's position in Venezuela at this point. Things might change if the price of oil goes down or a number of other factors take place. But at this point, Chavez is in solid control, in part because the opposition in Venezuela is so discredited and divided, as a matter of fact, at this point, so that the United States really can do very little to weaken Chavez's position. But it is true that during that crucial period, between the time of the coup, when the United States did actively support the effort to overthrow Chavez, and the recall election 2.5 years later, the United States may have been more effective in opposing Chavez had it not been for our commitments in Iraq.
Greg Grandin, your response to that question, did Iraq save Latin America?
Oh, I agree completely with what Steve just said. I think Iraq was part of a larger kind of confluence of events that have led to this deterioration of the U.S.'s standing. And it's not just that Iraq diverted the U.S.'s attention, which it did that also, but it also led to, the declining U.S. dollar, which means the access to U.S. markets aren't as important as they were for Latin American economies in the past. The ability of the rising price of oil, which is very in a complex way related to the disaster of a foreign policy in Iraq, has led to the strengthening of this bloc that has allowed Chavez to serve as an alternative source of credit to Latin American nations, to Argentina and Ecuador and Brazil, weakening in turn the IMF. I think there's a lot of ways in which this disaster, this military overreach and kind of imperial hubris in Iraq, led to a kind of breathing space for Latin America. But I also think there are real structural changes taking place in the world that has led to the deterioration of the United States. Latin American nations have been very good recently at leveraging the kind of centrifugal forces of globalization in order to break free of, or give themselves some wiggle room vis-a-vis Washington, vis-a-vis United States economy. And I think this would have happened even without Iraq. I think Iraq maybe accelerated things. I mean, Latin American leftists and even non-leftists, there's a lot of differences in style and policy which kind of mainstream commentators like to point out in showing that Chavez's influence is limited. But I think they share a common set of this common agenda that transcends those differences. One is, as I talked about, looking for a diversification of capital, a diversification of markets, regional integration, and then strengthening the role of the state and the economy to lessen inequality. And going back to one of your earlier questions about Chavez setting the agenda for the United States, is one of the things that's interesting about Bush's rhetoric is his attention not just to growth, economic growth, but economic inequality. And this, I think, is one of the key shifts that the Latin American left can take credit for, is shifting the terms of the debate away from just growth to the deep, deep inequality of Latin America.
We're going to come back to this conversation. We're talking to Greg Grandin. He's a professor of Latin American history at New York University, NYU. He also is the author of Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Rise of the New Imperialism. Steve Elner is also with us. He's co-author of the new book called Venezuela. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Las caleñas son como las flores, que vestidas van de mil colores. Ellas nunca entregan sus amores si no están correspondidas. Caminando van por las aceras, contoneando llevan su cintura. Ellas mueven las caderas como los cañaverales. Las caleñas son como las flores, que vestidas van de mil colores. Ellas nunca entregan sus amores si no están correspondidas.
Just like it's yours, we're Americans. And our fellow Americans are dying as we're standing here today. We are dependent on our Congress, but our Congress is dependent.
Ellas mueven las caderas como los cañaverales. Las caleñas son
como las flores.
Las sencillas son
como violetas.
Las bonitas son
como gardenias.
Las hermosas son
como las rosas. Las
Grandin, professor of Latin American Studies at New York University. His book is called Empire's Workshop. We're also joined by Steve Elner, just up from Venezuela, where he has taught for many years political science at the University, Universidad de Oriente in Puerto La Cruz in Venezuela. And he is co-author of the book Venezuela, Hugo Chavez and the Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. Professor Grandin, I wanted to ask you about this 20th anniversary that we just passed, the 20th anniversary of Iran-Contra, and what that has to do with Latin America and Iran today. And for people who are not familiar with what happened in November of 1986, explain it briefly.
Oh, in November 1986, the Iran-Contra scandal broke in the press. A small article in a Lebanese newspaper reported that the U.S. Rogue agents within the National Security Council of the U.S. sold missiles to Iran illegally. And then later on, it was reported that the money was diverted to support the Contras by passing a congressional law prohibiting funding of the anti-communist mercenaries, which was set up to destabilize the Sandinista government. And a scandal went on for years and led to multiple investigations. But it kind of petered out in many ways. It didn't really damage the Republicans. George H.W. Bush was elected, I think, a month after the Senate report was released. He went on to pardon everybody who was convicted under Iran-Contra, including a number of people in the current administration. But it has to do
Elliot
with
Abrams,
Elliot Abrams and another number of other people. What it has to do with the current moment is that Iran-Contra and Reagan's Central American policy more broadly goes back to the point that I made earlier, that the United States turns to Latin America to regroup after crises and after global crises. And this was the Reagan administration, the rising new right, the rising conservative movement, coming to power in early 1981, turning to Latin America to respond to the serial cascading crises of the 1970s, economic, political, a moral crisis, which really discredited American power in the world. And Central America really becomes the crucible that brings together the different foreign policy constituents which make up, which kind of stand behind George Bush's post 9/11 kind of revolution in diplomatic affairs. In particular, it brought together for the first time first generation of neoconservative intellectuals and the religious right. And these are the two groups which give Bush's preemptive warfare doctrine both its legal and intellectual legitimacy, that's the neoconservatives, and its grassroots energy, and that's the religious right. That alliance kind of comes apart after the election of George H.W. Bush and then obviously during the Clinton administration, but after 9/11, it reforms. Iran-Contra really is about the conservative movement's first sustained attempt to restore the power of the imperial presidency to wage unencumbered, unauthorized war vis-a-vis the congressional and judicial branch. This kind of theory of strong executive power that's now in the news that the Bush administration has been a staunch defender of. This really goes back in many ways to Iran-Contra as the first kind of sustained attempt to kind of roll back all of those restrictions placed on the executive branch in the wake of Vietnam, in the wake of Watergate. And that's what Iran-Contra was.
Well, Greg Grandin and Steve Elner, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Greg Grandin, the author of Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Rise of the New Imperialism. And Steve Elner, who teaches political science in Venezuela and is author, co-author of the new book, Venezuela, Hugo Chavez and the Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. As we wrap up today's broadcast in Tacoma, Washington, where peace activists are continuing to campaign to prevent the military from shipping 300 Stryker-armored vehicles to Iraq. On Sunday, 23 protesters were arrested, including T.J. Johnson, who serves in the City Council of Olympia. He just got out of jail and joins us on the phone. Welcome to Democracy Now!, T.J. Johnson. We just have 2 minutes. Explain what happened this weekend. Why did you get arrested?
I can hardly hear you. I'm getting drowned out by the rally.
Prevent the deployment of the 4th Stryker Brigade as part of President Bush's escalation of the conflict in Iraq.
And what exactly did you do?
Well, 23 people were arrested yesterday. 8 of those people were arrested for violating a ban on backpacks in the protest zone, and they were arrested First Amendment rights. An additional 15 people, including myself, were arrested as we attempted to deliver a citizen's injunction to halt the shipment of military material to Iraq.
And, well, what is happening now?
Well, all 23 of the people arrested yesterday are now out of jail. We were released approximately 2 hours ago. The campaign to continue our opposition to the use of our publicly funded ports to support the escalation of the conflict in Iraq will continue for as long as it needs to. We're into this for 8 days now. I believe we have over a total of 30 people have been arrested at this point, and spirits are still high and resistance remains strong.
What kind of support are you getting in the community?
Quite a bit. We put out a call for people to witness the action by the 23 individuals yesterday, and we had over 100 people show up there to witness that action, to videotape the action, to take still photographs, and to document what was going on. And we continue to receive positive feedback via the website, email, telephone calls, both from throughout Western Washington and around the nation.
T.J. Johnson, I want to thank you for being with us. Just out of jail, Olympia City Councilman protesting Stryker vehicles being sent to Iraq. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke and Sharifa Mdokadoush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aramate, Jen Yutz, Anuradha Bhagwati, Megan Whitney, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira, engineers, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.